edition of Radio War Nerd. This will be episode 25. The day today is St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, 2016. I'm Mark Ames. I'm in Queens, New York, and I'm online with the War Nerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher. So, John, happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
Well, happy St. Patrick's Day to you. I got an email today from my friend Dan who said if anybody says that to him, though, he's going to punch them in the face and explain when they're on the ground, I'm a fucking American.
How very Irish of him.
Very, very Irish. That's how you express your tender affection for the old sod.
So I don't know if you saw this, actually. There was a tiny little scandal involving Gerry Adams of Sinn Féin, whom we spoke about a couple shows ago, where he was invited, maybe it was even for today, I don't know, he was invited to the White House, but apparently he was told that he was going to have to go through standard security, like a TSA pat-down or something. And he's, you know, he said, are you out of your mind? I'm a big leader, and you know you don't do that. And it was a slight, and they didn't change protocol for him. So did everybody
else have to go through this?
I don't know. I mean, he doesn't seem like the type who would, if everybody else had to. I don't know, to be honest.
He doesn't seem like the type to take offense. I mean, I remember him recounting with great good humor an incident where he told his counterparts in some negotiation with the British government, if you do that, all bets were off. And he said, 2 weeks later, I find myself tied to a chair with some sergeant punching me in the face. And every time he punches me, he said, all bets are off, eh, Jerry? All bets are off. So I don't think he'd hold a grudge.
No. I just popped it up real quickly. Here's the headline from yesterday: Gerry Adams, Sinn Féin leader, skips White House visit over security. This is the New York Times. Gerry Adams, the prominent Irish politician, accused the Obama administration of singling him out after he was after he was stopped at the gates of the White House on Tuesday for a lengthy security check when he arrived for a St. Patrick's Day reception. Yeah, it was for a St. Patrick's Day reception.
Yeah.
I arrived at the proper time and had all the appropriate documentation, he said in a telephone interview, but the guard told him there was, quote, an issue of security. I wasn't disturbed when they said they had a problem because that happens all the time, he said, adding that he felt as if he were in a receiving line greeting the other guests as they filed past him. So it does sound like he was. Wow. But after waiting more than an hour, Mr. Adams left. Whoa. It's like he got face controlled.
Yeah, that's strange. Well, it's a very cautious administration.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's no such thing as an Irish vote in the U.S., so what's the upside of letting in somebody who will furnish a lot of tabloid headlines in Britain? You know, Obama fets IRA man.
I guess not, but I think he's been invited.
If I try to think, has he? He used to be inadmissible, literally. I mean, I remember long ago, Bernadette McCaskey came over, and she always said the reason she was allowed to do that is she was smart enough not to join any organization, at least not officially, because for a long time, back when I was involved in this stuff, if you belonged to Sinn Féin, you had a hard time getting in at all.
Well, it says here, let's see, Peter King. Peter King is his biggest advocate, which is always just weird.
That guy.
But apparently, Mr. Adams has been a familiar figure at the White House since President Bill Clinton first welcomed him there in what was then a controversial gesture. It's not even controversial.
Being an Irish American is all the other Irish Americans. Peter King.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that happened. Is St. Patrick's Day? I mean, did you celebrate it when you were younger, or I mean, was this a point of pride or embarrassment? Or I mean,
Mark, it depends on what you mean by celebrate, as applied to the Dolan family.
Yes, lots of mirth, huh?
mirth abounded. We always went to the parade in San Francisco, and I would always count the attendees from an early age and satisfy myself that they were dwindling each year and that assimilation and immiseration, which should have canceled each other out but didn't, you know, which were in my mind a kind of idiosyncratic stagflation that affected only our family, that they would proceed at the same time and that the Irish would become less and less marked and distinct, and at the same time less and less integrated and powerful. So plus there was the fact that I didn't feel particularly close to the people who were marching in that parade. What I remember distinctly is how much it meant to my father, who was a very unhappy and frightened man. My mother took the view that Catholicism was more important than Irishness. My father's family went very much the other way, although they also were the only ones who contributed Jesuits to the family. My mother's family didn't do that, don't get me started. But it was for me a very sad event when I was young, but most events were. Later, when I was involved in the Irish Northern Aid stuff, I distributed flyers that I designed at the St. Patrick's Day Parade, and they did work, but they worked on about 1 out of 1,000 people who got them. And
what was the message?
The headline was Ireland, not just a pretty place, and it was a page of text framed in pictures of people who'd been hit by bullets, either real or plastic. The trouble is, a friend of a friend was helping to distribute them, and she kept getting, "Hey, baby, not just a pretty face,
oh,
huh?"
Jesus, yeah.
But really, the only friend I got from all my cool radical buddies at Berkeley who would actually show up for the parade, and I'll always remember this, it was a friend from Hunan province who called himself Newton Liu, because, as he said cheerfully, because Newton was a genius and so am I, which he sort of was. I mean, it wasn't his real name, but he just didn't even want to hear us try to pronounce his real name. Mm-hmm. So he called himself Newton. And I had managed to help Newton get his wife here on a permanent visa. And in this admirable and very Chinese way, he felt that we were friends. And he owed me loyalty. And so Newton, who was this 5-foot-nothing genius, is handing out these Irish 6 counties flyers at the San Francisco St. Patrick's Day Parade, along with a speed-addled me and a bunch of friends of Mitzi's. And I think that's possibly the most cinematic event of my life. Because I don't think that has ever happened before. And when I try to imagine Newton's state of consciousness while he was doing it, it's not easy. But, you know, he had grown up in a city that was part of the Civil War between Red Guards and factory militias. Mm. He said he and his friends used to make a game. He asked me to help him translate his memoir called Flying Out of the Poor Nest. And in his memoir, he describes this game that he and his friends played when he was a child, which involved running across the street during a firefight and seeing if you could avoid getting hit by the bullets.
Wow.
The way you won the game, you see, was get hit by the bullets.
Wow. So is this during the Cultural Revolution? Or?
Yeah. When he was a kid, which is why he was 5-foot-nothing, because he also starved, and his mother and his sister both hanged themselves. Right. And when I imagine, I mean, I was pretty committed to this stuff at the time, but even so, it did get to me that it must occur to Newton that this was a bunch of goddamn nonsense. Mm-hmm. But I knew very well that he was doing it because I helped him. We were friends. And neither of us felt very comfortable in the UC Berkeley rhetoric department.
Oh, so he was in the rhetoric department also.
Oh, yeah. He was a grad student.
I mean, one thing that comes to my mind, though, is that he may not have been judging it in that way. If he knew it meant something to you. I think the thing that stands out in my mind, though, is how many people would have been averse to doing American-born, because it might have left a mark on their record and might have set their career back. And it just probably that did not occur to him.
No, it didn't occur to him at all.
That fear.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. That's, I mean, it's typical Berkeley stuff. No one said that, but it was clear that everyone thought that. And I have to say, although I'm not pleased that they did that, I have to say they were right, because at the end of the parade, when our little cadre, as we called it. I'm raising my fist right now. When our little cadre was gathered at the end of the parade by the city center, an incident happened that I've described in an article I wrote recently called My Human Terrain. Mm-hmm. Our little group was almost certainly penetrated many times over, but apparently it wasn't penetrated enough, because when we hit the end of the parade, I was suddenly approached by this guy who was like 6'4", taller than you, well, about as tall as you, and totally steroid casualty, and leaning forward very aggressively, decked out in a watch cap and a leather jacket and mm-hmm. Doc Martens, and he just started talking nonstop. He said, "Hey, I'm from the Irish American Skinhead organization. Jesus. What we do is we help ethnic Americans who are disadvantaged by affirmative action and stuff." In other words, he'd gotten totally the wrong angle on our crowd.
Right.
And thought that he would try being some sort of right-wing skinhead. But if you've ever seen anything resembling an authentic skinhead, if there even is such a thing, and there are a few, or there were a few, mm-hmm. They look like they've been doing speed for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
This guy looked like he'd been working out and taking protein powder for
his in the time. Police gym.
Yeah. I mean, he was like that Keanu Reeves line from Point Break: "Sir, I take the skin off chicken." And it was totally unconvincing, and he would not stop talking.
Mm-hmm.
And as he saw that I was sort of looking at him impassively, and the Collins brothers, who were sort of our enforcers, were standing near me. They didn't exactly like or trust me, but I had no doubt what would happen if he tried anything. He starts play punching me, and he starts play punching me in the gut. And I was a fat, underpaid, overworked instructor at the time, and you know, I felt bad enough about that. And he's sort of play punching me like a millimeter from my gut, and none of us, as I recall, and I don't know if this can be true, but as far as I recall, none of us said anything to him. And the monologue went on for like a couple of minutes, which in those terms is a very long time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then he vanished. And for such a big guy, he vanished very quickly. He was good at that, but he was incredibly bad at the rest of the stuff. I mean, I've mm-hmm. met a few people that I thought were a little like not hardcore James Bond types, but stringers, you know,
mm-hmm.
Miserable, unpaid or low-paid intelligence people. I met a few in Kurdistan, but this guy was the worst of the worst.
Yeah,
I mean, he had no finesse at all.
They probably moved him back to parking tickets after that failure. You know, but I, one thing that strikes me though, because one of the ugliest sort of insights into that world that I got was researching the article about the Anti-Defamation League spying, you know, on the anti-apartheid protesters that I got caught up in back in the late 80s, early 90s. And so this story wound up getting into the world of informants in the Bay Area especially. And of course, the ADL had their own creepy informant who looked like John Wayne Gacy on steroids also. And then his buddy was the CIA contractor, SFPD police intelligence guy, Tom Girard. And then they all had their assets. And I remember, if you remember the one story where they had some assets in the skinhead movement. And then there were two competing Jewish organizations, both the Simon Wiesenthal Center and the ADL. I think both had assets in this one. Maybe it was the National Alliance. I can't remember which skinhead group it was. And somebody wanted, I think somebody from the ADL wanted the job at the Wiesenthal Center because it paid better. So they were going to have their informant in the skinhead group knock off the guy from the Simon Wiesenthal Center who was penetrating the skinheads. I mean, it was, it's pretty wacky stuff. But those organizations are definitely deeply infiltrated. And, you know, when you think about like the Greensboro shooting, which you remember when there was an anti-Klan rally and the Klan came in, they just gunned down on TV, recorded everything, like six people, and then got in their cars and drove away.
I don't know about that, but this was, I mean, a heroic, if not very bright, moment when these some kind of leftist group mm-hmm. challenged the Klan right in Greensboro,
right.
And the Klan took it seriously and showed up with automatic weapons. And these people, I don't know what it is about certain leftist groups, but I remember, you know, the Revolutionary Communist Youth Brigade showing up with staffs in Berkeley. And these people also showed up with staffs. I'm talking about wooden sticks, big wooden sticks. And they were brave, God knows, because there's a video of this, and it shows them charging these fat goons with automatic rifles and semi-automatic shotguns. And they charge and they charge, and then all of them are falling and dying.
Yeah. And they all got off, too. Because I'm sure probably half of them were informants as well.
Yeah.
And then again, there were a lot of informants in the communist side, but they would never show up at something like that. They would know to sort of skittle away at the last minute.
Yep.
So anyway, how did we get on that? So St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah. But anyway, no, it's. I mean, I don't know what St. Patrick's Day means in Turin. Although Turin is an interesting place, I see IRA signs all over town here. It's strange. Mm. They're clearly from long ago, but I'm told by friends here that there's a tradition of Catholic radicalism here. I don't quite know what Catholic radicalism really means. Dorothy Day, I guess? I don't know. But anyway, there are some echoes of that. And there's something going on now called an Irish festival. But again, local people told me, no, that's New Age stuff. Don't go near it. Mm. And that works on me. So
Are there the usual Irish pubs? That's one thing that sort of struck me certainly in Russia and a lot of, developing country places, there's always these Irish pubs.
Yeah, you'd think there were, but no, I don't think there are. I mean, Italians have the whole bar thing down. Mm-hmm. I don't think they need to borrow anybody's traditions. I think their conviction would be that other people need to borrow their traditions.
Right. So no celebration for you and Catherine tonight, but happy.
Well, yeah, there is a celebration.
Are you wearing green?
No, but I had, you know, talking about the perverse and oxymoronic nature of Irish loyalties, I had a favorite professor named Dan Melia, whom you may remember.
Yeah.
And Dan used to say, no, I don't wear green on St. Patrick's Day. Just as I don't wear, I don't know, he made some other analogy to some ethnic holiday that would be deemed insulting. And Dan always talked that way about anything Irish. He would always have a sneer and a laugh for it. And it was clearly the only thing he cared about in the world. Mm. It was very typical. But part of that was never, never wearing green. Just like my friend Dan saying, anybody says St. Patrick's Day to me, I'm going to punch him. They wonder why we never get anywhere.
Okay, so...
The good news is, I think I can announce this now, Catherine's book about our year in Najran is getting published in Italian. It's going to be translated into Italian by this really great translator in Turin. And it's called Girls of the Empty Quarter. I'm not sure how they'll translate that, but it's a great memoir about our time there.
And, well, congratulations to Catherine.
Yeah,
Girls of the Empty Quarter.
Yeah, because there's a famous book in Saudi called Girls of Riyadh, and it's playing off that, because Girls of Riyadh is like, what's that show about women in New York?
Sex in the City?
Sex in the City, yeah. Uh-huh. It's like that, but it's all about elite women, and what Catherine encountered when she taught in Najran was women who were mostly from the Shia minority. They're not poor. Nobody's poor in Saudi if you're a citizen. But they're far from those Riyadh socialites that are described in Girls of Riyadh.
Oh, wow. Okay. That sounds great. So when can Italian readers expect to see the book?
I guess a few months, three months probably.
Excellent. Wow, that's great. All right. Congratulations. Moving on. So back to the world of wars and the big news and the big sort of questions people are asking has to do with Putin's surprise announcement. Surprise certainly to everybody in the West, probably less of a surprise to some people who are paying, I think, very close attention to things Putin was saying. But anyway, it was a surprise that he's withdrawing, which is, I think, the most surprising thing. You and I were talking about it, is just that it's just not something we would ever do. I mean, we might talk the talk early on. We often do that. It's a limited campaign and we have limited goals, but it always turns into something open-ended and full of hand-wringing and passing it on to somebody else.
We tend to withdraw, when all is lost. I mean, this is withdrawing at a very different point when the Russia's proxies were winning. And that's why I have to admit, this caught me by surprise. Mm-hmm. And it made me realize, I think I've learned to think in something other than a conventional American way about irregular war. But I think when it comes to conventional wars, this showed me that I still think in pretty pedestrian American terms, because I just didn't see the withdrawal coming. And I should have, because the Russians were saying this will be a 3 to 4 month campaign. Mm-hmm. And it ended up being 5.5 months, but not all of those were particularly active. So I should have seen it coming, and I didn't. And I will learn.
Right. In fact, I'd like to read here something from an article on October 2nd, that should have been 2000. That's 2015. So this is last year. This is right when the Russians first moved in.
It began on September 30th.
All right. And as we discussed a few shows back, on that day and the next couple of days, everything was Russia will fail, Russia will fail, Russia's going to be sucked into a quagmire. I had people writing me, calling me, snickering, like, this is it, Putin now is finally done it. He stepped in shit, and, there's no way he's getting out of this, so on and so forth. See, this is the problem. I think this is why it's hard to anticipate something like this. I mean, Putin's not a likable guy, and yet he strategically, on the matters we talk about, I mean, he keeps doing things pretty close to, right. I mean,
I've been so eager to find something that I can sneer at Putin for, but no, he's doing pretty well.
Yeah, it's kind of embarrassing, and you certainly don't want to get ahead of him and think that, well, this guy is so great and so smart. I mean, but this is a prejudice that we're bringing into whatever we might expect out of him. We don't want to get ahead of it and say, oh, but he will pull out in 3 to 4 months, as some of his people are saying, because he's that smart. Well, then you sound like an asshole and you get bashed for the next 3 or 4 months.
Right.
You don't know what's
going to
happen.
Yeah, you're expecting lies. I mean, it reminds me of Freud used to tell a joke, right, about two... I think it goes, there are these, one old Polish Jew meets another in the railway station and says, so where are you going today? And the other one says, I'm going to Krakow. And the first one says, oh, okay. And then he wanders back to his wife and says, that lying bastard, why is he trying to tell me he's going to Krakow when I know he's actually going to Krakow?
Yeah, well, it is like that with Putin and with sort of trying to figure out Putin as well. So I just want to read this real quick. This is from a Reuters article from October 2nd. Russian airstrikes in Syria to last 3 to 4 months, Putin ally. And this is a very close ally, Alexei Pushkov. Russia estimates this airstrike campaign in Syria could last 3 to 4 months. The head of the lower house of the Russian parliament, the head of the Duma, Foreign Affairs Committee said on Friday, quote, and this guy was a big TV presenter for a while. There is always a risk of being bogged down, but in Moscow, we are talking about an operation of 3 to 4 months, unquote. Alexei Pushkov, an ally of Putin, told French radio station Europe One. He added that strikes were going to intensify, which is also true. They started off slower and they built up. Pushkov said the strikes mainly targeted Islamic State. That's not true. Forces, in spite of reports that they had concentrated on opponents to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Quote, the opponents to Bashar are very close to Daesh. So they basically just redefined what Islamic State means to something broader.
Well, that's not entirely wrong either. One of the most impressive things in the campaign was destroying the leadership of Ahrar al-Sham, which was a very big, powerful Sunni militia. And the leaders, the Asud clan, basically, are on record saying again and again, all the Christians will be exiled, all the Alawites will be killed. It doesn't really matter so much if they had a few doctrinal disputes with Islamic State. They're still a sectarian militia and a pretty nasty one.
Yeah.
So, there are two lies going around, the Russian one that all these people are Islamic State, and the American one that they're all Michael Weiss's wonderful democratic pro-Western people. And I have to say the Russian one is a slightly smaller lie than yes. Michael Weiss.
Well, and the other one that which the Michael Weiss people tell, which is that ISIS is actually a creation of Russia and Assad. And Putin is ISIS's air force and all this other crap. Another piece that also gave a strong hint of what Putin's actual intentions were, because he did talk up. I mean, everybody I think knows. I think Putin also, knowing the sort of the unromantic cynicism of the Russian elites on these matters, I think they've all sort of looked at how we talk that about going in there to fight ISIS as everybody's lying about this. We're all sort of lying about this. We all have other interests. This is the lie we use. So I'll use the same one that the Americans and the Saudis were claiming they were going to go in to fight ISIS, which they helped create, everybody, the Turks, right? We're going to start bombing ISIS. And instead, of course, they bombed the Kurds. So it's just sort of like, okay, this is the convenient lie. But in any event, he did say to Rasiyadin, to ORT, the national television, this would, I think, be the 10th of October. Our goal is to stabilize the legal, the lawful regime, zakonny vlast, and create conditions for a political compromise. That's what he said the goals are. And they did it.
They did it. And as you're, I think you know this guy, Simon, Sarajan.
Yeah.
As he said, there's another reason for Russia to make it a short, fast, hard campaign, which is that Russia has its own Sunni Muslim audience to consider. And I'll read a bit of what he said here.
Sure.
Putin's decision to cut the campaign short helps limit the growing anger among Sunni in Russia. This reduces the terrorist threat. Watch for Russia's remaining planes to focus on attacking Islamic State and Nusra. In fact, the desire to limit damage to Russia's reputation in the eye of Sunni, including Russia's own, might have been why the chair of State Duma's International Affairs Committee, Alexei Pushkov, that guy you're talking about, predicted in October that the air campaign would last only a few months.
Right. That was in the Boston Globe, I think, a day or two ago. Yeah, it's a really good piece. I mean, he lays out all the reasons why it makes sense, why he's – and remember, it's not a total withdrawal. Major scaling down and going quiet, basically.
Yeah, it's also a scaling down of what was in the beginning a small, very small campaign. I mean, we're talking about 40 aircraft and the personnel you need to keep them going and protect them. Even the inflated American estimates of the cost of this campaign come to about $1.25 billion. And that's a lot of money to normal people, but in terms of conducting a foreign war, that's nothing. And also, it's probably vastly overestimated because, when the American intelligence community estimates what roughly an enemy power is paying, it's pretty much like when cops tell you the street value of some drug haul they've got. It's inflated by about 500%.
Well, and also think about the things that they've got for this, right? I mean, you had the goals, but what did they actually get for this? Number one, they're probably going to sell far more than $1.25 billion or whatever that figure was in arms, because this was essentially also a big arms marketing opportunity.
Absolutely.
So there's that, which is a direct profit. And then there are a lot of indirect profits. I mean, assuming that it succeeds, they will have, for the first time, I don't know, that I've seen since the collapse of the Soviet Union, they will have actually saved a client that is not on their border. And I mean, they've only been losing clients one after the other. So they've actually saved a client, and that's going to translate into business. I mean, more business, more markets.
You can see the triumphalism in the Russian videos that are coming out of Syria, and there are some great Russian videos in Syria. Often they have pop tunes, soundtracks, and they use all kinds of cool camera tricks. And there's this delight that these probably young Russian guys are seeing their country blasting away again. It's not particularly admirable, but it's probably understandable. So there's also the the jingoist benefit, which is mm-hmm. quite a benefit. I mean, we've lived through American expeditions, which at least in the early stages had that same euphoria mm-hmm. about them.
Sure. Yeah. And I think I mentioned this in one of our earlier shows. I can't remember, but, I remember once being with Limonov before when he was with the liberal opposition back in 2007-08 with Garry Kasparov, and it was before one of their big demonstrations in Pushkin Square, and we were talking again about, you know, Bush and Iraq and this stuff, because Kasparov, I had just written an article about Kasparov's ties to all these crazy neocons like Frank Gaffney and so on, and then Limonov, you know, he always had the kind of very I mean, he has this reputation of being a real, you know, crazy extremist and so on. But actually, when you talk to him, he's remarkably earthy. You know, I think it always surprises people. Yeah. He kind of just boils things down to sort of the simple kind of hard truth or something. And what he said was, you know, Russians over here, at least, are not really angry about America invading Iraq because of the injustice of it. What really makes them angry is that they can't do it. And what all Russians really want is they look back in pride to the last great moment, which was when they occupied Czechoslovakia in 1968 and no one could do anything about it. And we would just look and say, see, we're just like the Americans. The Americans, they go overseas and they occupy somebody. We can go, you know, to a country and just move in and everyone's scared of us. And our Russian wow. boys are like marching around and they, you know, succumb to us. And he said, that is what, I don't care who it is, you know, except for a very tiny number of very, very tiny number of sort of, you know, liberal intelligentsia.
Oh, that, yeah. I remember yeah. even that Cold War book, Homo Sovieticus. Mm-hmm. Is that Zinoviev?
Zinoviev, yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And he's supposedly blasting the Soviet Union. But there's this hilarious scene where he ends up watching the West German, as it was at the time, the West German army, the Bundeswehr, which was not a very serious force, playing around in this half-hearted way, trying to inflate one of the rafts across a little river. And he's just watching these guys and thinking, oh, we'll come on a Sunday. Our boys, they'll take revenge. Oh, yeah. What revenge they'll take.
Yeah, I think Zinoviev did go that way as things fell apart in Russia. I think he went very much towards the nationalist way. So I think that this does play well at home, so long as it doesn't drag on too long. So for domestic purposes, it makes sense for him to pull out. And again, and as I also told you earlier when this first happened, look, this is what Putin did in Georgia. It was very...
I have to say, you were a lot more right about this than I was.
I mean, it's just because I think I saw this up close. I remember when the Russians pushed back against it. First of all, everybody, the neocons, Saakashvili, all of his American advisors and so on, were sure that they would take South Ossetia really fast, and there was and the Russians wouldn't do anything in response, because generally they didn't yet at that point. They stayed within their borders and, you know, didn't do anything when the Green Berets were introduced and sort of were losing a lot of the Caucasus in Central Asia. And they were really convinced, if we take it fast, there's nothing he can do. And they were wrong. And then the Russians moved in. First, they had their irregulars go in, and then they sent the tanks through the Roki Tunnel into South Ossetia. And then they just destroyed the Georgians, and everybody fled, including their American and Israeli advisors or wherever they were. And then they took Gori, which was Stalin. So they moved into Georgia proper, took Gori, Stalin's birthplace. And then I remember the whole thing shifted. The narrative shifted to, Russia is a crazy imperial power. They're restoring the Soviet Empire. This is all about getting rid of the Thomas Jefferson of the Caucasus of Saakashvili.
Which he was at the time.
Yeah. And it was an hour drive from Gori to Tbilisi, and Saakashvili was terrified. There was that famous photo of him eating his tie and hiding under his desk and everything. But the Russians were saying, no, we're not doing that. And in fact, so I went in, I was with a reporter's pool. We went in with the Russian army into Gori, and they were actually bragging about how they weren't going to move on. They were boasting about how scared Saakashvili was and how scared his backers were. And they said, of course we could take it if we want to, but why take it? why create problems for ourselves, you know? And it really bothered the hell out of, especially, you know, in the Bush years. Like, it's not possible that you could do something rationally and intelligently in matters of war. But they did, they pulled back. And then I remember after that, it was like, well, then this means he's going to invade somewhere else. He's going to invade Estonia, or he's going to invade Ukraine next, immediately. And he's just preparing to do it right now. And that didn't happen, I mean, really, until we helped overthrow Yanukovych. So yeah, this does fit more into Putin's style.
Yeah. No, it makes sense now. And what troubles me a little is how much sense it makes.
Yes.
And I mean, I knew it would be a successful campaign. I can't say I was wrong about that, but I didn't know it would be such a delimited one. And that's very intelligent, because these asymmetrical or roughly regular wars can be and usually are endless. And the only way you're going to change that is to declare an end to your involvement, or at least your involvement at the moment. And when they do that, suddenly you see a lot of advantages. Like Assad, I don't know how much this has to do with it, but Assad started getting a little cocky toward the second month of the Russian intervention, when the strikes really started to hit hard. And it does look like they hit hard. It looks like they were very good strikes, either because they were using a slightly looser rule of engagement, or because they had better intelligence from their Alawite officer friends, 10,000 or so of whom trained with Russian or Soviet forces. So for whatever reason, the airstrikes were starting to hit. They were starting to move in on Aleppo. And at that moment, Assad, who looks like that guy Beaker from the Muppet Show,
very,
you know,
Beaker,
he suddenly comes up with, we are going to reconquer all of Syria. And you can just imagine a Russian advisor saying, whoa, take it easy there, Tex. You definitely don't have the troops to do that, and we're not going to supply them to you.
Or it's more like, yeah.
When they're gone, he can't have any such delusions. And they've weakened his enemies, and now that they've left, they've weakened him too. And that's the only reason I can think of that the ceasefire is holding, which is the other great anomaly of Syria right now. The ceasefire is holding. I mean, it's a weird ceasefire. It doesn't include the Kurds or Islamic State or Jabhat al-Nusra, but it includes most of the places where the SAA and its Shia allies are engaged against Sunni militias, and it's holding remarkably. So it looks like the Russian intervention wore out the Sunni militias, blasted their supply lines, and slapped some sense into them. And then the Russian withdrawal slapped some sense into Assad. And if they did that much, maybe they actually have created something like conditions for negotiations.
I mean, so I think what you have here is, I mean, so the real question becomes not, I suppose, why did Putin do something so rational and, you know, apparently quite intelligent and makes so much sense, but more, why can't we? I mean, this comes to domestic politics. You can't because you're always afraid of, you're always looking over your right shoulder, especially anytime you get involved in any intervention or you're being pushed to get involved in an intervention, right? You're always
Our intervention in Syria could not ever have made sense, because our real clients here are Saudi Arabia and Israel. And neither of them wants the Alawite minority to survive with any power. Maybe they don't want it to survive at all in Saudi Arabia's case. But that they also are not fond of, well, the Saudis at least are not fond of the Kurds, whom they consider godless communists. So the U.S. ended up backing Sunni militias that were fighting the Alawites, and backing the Kurds, who were fighting the Sunni militias in their own right. And because they didn't want to help Assad's people in any way, they wouldn't attack those Sunni militias in western and northwestern Syria, which, among other things, created a field of wide open fat targets for the Russians, because they attacked those targets and the U.S. had been leaving them alone.
Right. And then,
so the U.S. never had a policy. I mean, who are we backing? This imaginary Free Syrian Army that usually defected as soon as we gave it a bunch of expensive weapons and went over to whatever other militia could pay it better, which was usually a Sunni Saudi funded militia.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then you have John Kerry, who's, despite his dead demeanor, seemed to be a little more excitable than I had assumed. The minute he took office, replaced Hillary, all he wanted to do was send cruise missiles. He thinks they send a message. And that was his
big thing. Maybe, right on the World War II style. This is for you, Rudolph.
Obama just, Obama comes off in that, what I've read of it, in that Jeffrey Goldberg piece, which is so, again, so bizarre. Why would you read anything by Jeffrey Goldberg? But nobody seemed to have come out and denied any of this. So it seems to have been, what, either what happened or what they want us to think happened. Obama just said no.
Yep. He was right. It didn't make any sense. I mean, when caution is the right answer, Obama is going to get it right.
Yeah.
Because that's, he's, at the end of his reign, which has been a big disappointment to people who really hoped for him, you have to admit that he is one cool-headed bastard. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why I think he is such a great master of assassins. And he's presided over the drone assassination campaign extremely effectively because he just keeps smiling and keeps looking patient and reasonable and cosmopolitan and well-traveled, which infuriates everybody in the U.S., but looks really good abroad. And meanwhile, the killing very effectively. So he made the right choice here because there was no sensible decision. I mean, the intervention they were planning in 2014 would have destroyed the Syrian Arab Army's air force, which is really its biggest advantage. And there would have been sectarian massacres that haven't been seen for quite a while. I mean, there have been little sectarian massacres like the Yazidi, but this would have been a big massacre.
Right. And now Kerry is, I think it's Kerry, is pushing Congress to declare that Islamic State is guilty of genocide. I'm not sure against who. I'd have to look. Is it against the Yazidi or?
I don't know what Kerry said, but they did do their best to commit genocide against the Yazidi. Yeah, they boast about that in their magazine, Dabiq, which reminds me, we have to get to our friend Michael Weiss, who actually quotes Dabiq in his latest article. But I've read Dabiq, and it's pretty scary. I mean, I've done this job a while, and I don't scare easy, but they actually say God will be angry at the Muslims on Judgment Day for not having wiped out the Yazidis sooner.
Wow.
And we have done a great thing by wiping them out, and we're proud of it.
Sounds really Old Testament Yahweh God. The one that they don't talk about.
When people don't understand Islamic State, I always want to quote one of Nietzsche's great aphorisms. And I've quoted it to you before, so you're going to have to suffer through it. But other people don't know this as well as they should. He said, almost a century and a half ago now, it is not their love for us that prevents today's Christians from burning us alive, but their lack of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. When you've lived in Saudi Arabia, in provincial Saudi Arabia especially, and you know what real faith is, and anyone who believes in any of the Abrahamic faiths in that way is terrifying. And you come home and you see the evangelicals, and you realize they're more like 19th century British Christians. That is, they see the social utility of their faith, but they don't believe the doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people in that part of the world really believe the doctrine. And the Abrahamic doctrines are always, with maybe the exception, you'd know better than me, the Gospel of Matthew or a few other things.
Yeah, a few of the Christian Gospels, yeah.
Yeah, always kill them all.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
So they have the book on theirs. They're right. I mean, I have friends. I don't communicate with them very well anymore because we sort of argued online. But that they won't even accept the idea that there is such a thing as Salafism or Wahhabism, because they say there is no such thing. We are simply following the book. And unfortunately, there's a lot of truth to that.
Mm. Yeah, well, and you can see this in Israel to a degree too. Yes. I mean, it was founded by more secular Jews, but eventually that's the identity they started, the people who were going more by the book, which tend to be the settlers and the ones who want to ethnically cleanse all outsiders. They really are going by the book.
Absolutely. The book is on their side. Let's face it.
And if they're going to be a Jewish state, they have to follow the book. And if the book says genocide all non-Jews, then, that's what a lot of them are going to believe. And it's pretty horrible.
And if you don't accept that, according to Jeffrey Goldberg, you are, what was his famous phrase? You are merely an anti-Zionist with Jewish parents.
Right. I forgot about that.
Rather than an actual Jew.
Right. Wow. So getting back to this again, we wanted to go over Michael Weiss's piece because there was a lot of, first there was sort of confusion, angry confusion over Putin's decision, disbelief, a refusal to accept it, and then trying to find a way to dismiss it. And I'm going to very quickly quote one of those, and then we'll get to Weiss's version, which is a bit different and kind of a clever militaristic version. But here's one in the Financial Times from, I don't know, a day or two ago. And its headline, Russia cuts its losses in Syria. That's the headline. So their angle is they've been destroyed and now they're fleeing with their head, with their tail between their legs. In six short months, Russia's military intervention in Syria has shifted the path of the... This is the thing. The headline doesn't quite correspond to the lead.
No,
six short months, Russia's military intervention in Syria has shifted the path of the country's grinding civil war, but by its own apparent objectives, the Kremlin's campaign has fallen short. Western defense analysts and diplomats note that an audit of Russian military and political objectives in Syria and a recall of Russian diplomatic tactics in Ukraine reveals a great deal still on the Kremlin's to-do list. And then I'll just quote one thing before it's babble. Because the article doesn't really back this up anywhere. But anyway, Britain's Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond, one of the most hawkish NATO politicians on Russia, told fellow UK parliamentarians on Tuesday that the withdrawal could ultimately be little more than a tactical feint. Quote, in dealing with Russia, he said, putting the caveat first is probably always sensible. So really the only the complaint here is just you can't believe him. There's no way they got done what they wanted to. They're lying. Don't believe it. It's the old Gorbachev is Stalin in a new suit or something, And then we get on to Michael Weiss.
Yeah. Well, if you thought that was fancy prose, wow, you haven't seen Michael Weiss's thing. I think Michael Weiss, for those of our listeners who may not know that he's one of our favorite targets here, Michael Weiss is a weirdly neocon amateur. He was an amateur Russia reporter, and now he's an amateur Syria reporter for reasons I don't fully grasp, because he doesn't seem to know much about either place. His explanation is that one day he was sitting at his PR desk at the Henry Jackson Society, and someone said, you'd better do Syria. Nobody else is doing Syria. And that's how he came to this job.
Right, because his Russia expertise, I mean, I'm not even sure if he could pronounce, Blini. Pelmeni. He knows no Russian. I don't even know if he's ever been to Russia. But he's become one of the leading television experts on Russia.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we talked about his interview with Sam Harris last time. Mm-hmm. In which he came across as the smart one. But that's not to say that he's a particularly smart person. Mm. And his latest article is really astounding. I mean, it's called Maybe Putin's Telling the Truth About Winning Syria. And this is, if you know old Michael Weiss, this is quite the shocker, because he's the one who's been saying it's a quagmire, it's a disaster, because basically whatever his CIA friends were feeding him.
And Saudi friends. I mean, but, he's had two, kind of compete. He always has very contradictory, PR goals that he seems to, he just lays out there and doesn't care that they're contradictory. And one is to denigrate Rush and say that, you know, everything's failing, everything's losing. But the other one also is to goad the Obama administration into war by taunting them that they're losing or that they're being weak or they're being having circles run around them and everyone's laughing at them. That, you know, so I think he combines those two. So to do that, he'll sort of say, Putin's winning and losing. He's winning to the extent that Obama looks bad. He's losing because Russia's losing, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think that's a tough ask for even a really good writer. And for Michael Weiss, it proved impossible. I mean, this article reads like the worst of high theory from the 1980s. And I had to live through that, and it left a mark on me. As our friend Eileen would say, it still hurts when it rains. And some of his prose...
Oh, it still hurts when it rains. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah. Some of his prose could fit easily into high theory. Like, here's the beginning of his second paragraph in this article, where he tries to come to terms with the bare possibility that he might have been wrong in his quagmire predictions. And he says, "The difficulty in parsing any major Kremlin announcement lies in chivying the kernel of verifiable truth out of the carapace of lies and disinformation it typically comes wrapped in." Some of the highlights of that were parsing, chivying, and kernel of verifiable truth, and carapace of lies and disinformation. I guess you sort of have to imagine a beetle with an armor composed of lies and disinformation, and inside that is a little corn-like kernel of truth, and in some way,
just
possibly
waiting to be chivied.
Yeah, you chivy it out. Yo, hey, tally-ho, with some sort of linguistic tool implied by parsing. I mean, that's how you know the Weiss matrix has been disturbed. You know, when he becomes a sort of pseudo-British prose generator.
Yeah, when his thesaurus starts to short out right in front of your eyes, then you know something's going on.
I think that he actually dug up the corpse of Christopher Hitchens and laid its dead hand on a randomly chosen word in the thesaurus and said, I'll start the second paragraph. Chivying, eh? All right. Tally-ho, and off we go. So as you say, he's actually got a very difficult job here, because he's trying to argue they won and they lost at the same time, and that's hard to do. And what he ends up doing is writing just gibberish. It's very spiteful gibberish. He seems personally angry about pretty much everything. He's personally angry
and trying not to show it. Right.
Right.
That's the thing. It's sort of this trying to be distanced and disgusted and not hurt personally, but it really does.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like he's got a cocktail in one hand and a cigarette holder in the other, and he's still pissed off and sulking.
Yeah.
And it's just not working. I mean, there was a paragraph here near the end. I'm trying to get to it now. And I actually tried to ask people for help on Facebook because I really didn't know what it was talking about. And, hey, I used to teach John Ashbery to first year, damn it. And I made them understand it. And I still don't know what this was. I think this is it. And I'm not leaving anything out. This is the quote. "Obama has euphemistically couched this Voltfass on 37 years of Islamic Republic containment as forcing two regional powers to share the neighborhood and institute some sort of cold peace, as if the devastating and largely forgotten war in Yemen were a prelude to therapeutic breakthrough between two mutually reviled sectarians rather than a curtain raiser on a new and improved era of proxy conflict."
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. I mean, that it's somebody who's trying to sound smart, well-educated, writerly, and has
very
nothing to say.
Yeah.
Nothing at all.
Because, he seems to forget that Yemen is a war in which very expensive Saudi planes are bombing the shit out of Shia civilians. And apparently this is hurting the Saudis in some way. I don't know how. And since his real enemy here is Iran, it's always Iran and the Russians, because that's what the Saudis told him to say, it somehow means that bombing Shia Yemenis is hurting the Saudis. I have no idea. Usually when there's that antithesis, you know, X rather than Y, one of those is a good term. But here, the choices are two horrible-sounding terms, and I really don't know what he's getting at.
Well, let's look at it a different way for a second. Maybe, because as I've told you, the best way to try to understand Michael Weiss is to imagine what he really is, which is he's a marketing guy.
Right.
He's a marketing guy. He has clients who give him a sort of a public relations problem, and then they need him to spin it in a certain way. And he'll look at his audience, and if the audience are American readers, of foreign policy, so these are people who tend to be, you know, more educated, more elite, but at the same time, intellectually insecure. And so they will, if they read something that doesn't make sense to them, they'll never say, wait a minute, this makes no sense. They'll say, wow, he's smart. I get, you know.
Oh. He's slipping them into agreeing. Yeah. That's true. There's another great Nietzsche line. The mediocre will always see obscurity as profundity. Yeah.
Yeah.
That does fit all too well. And in conclusion with the pretension theory, this is the final paragraph. It's a very brief one. If, as the old Clausewitz cliche runs, war merely continuation of politics by other means, then why should Putin waste any more of his contracting GDP on gravity bombs and bullets when his enemy is already furthering his policy cost-free? I don't even know what that means. And why gravity bombs?
I get that. That's their big thing, because they want us, guys like him, to believe that we've been surgically bombing and been very careful only to hit MSF hospitals only in Afghanistan. And you know, the Syrian clients have barrel bombs and the Russians have gravity bombs. It sounds bad.
Yeah.
Gravity's old. Smart is new.
I see. Okay, yeah. And Russians have... Yeah, he does spend a lot of time talking about Russians killing civilians. In fact, the whole article is a description of admittedly sleazy things that the Russian military forces do. The only problem is they learned all that from America. Like he says, they're trying to sell their weapons abroad with this Syrian war. Well, yes, they are. Where do you think they learned that? Everything about this Russian intervention screams that there have been Kremlin offices with the lights on all night for years studying American policy.
Yeah.
I mean, everything except leaving early. That's why I didn't get it, because I thought
they would maybe study our failures too. But also theirs. I mean, look, Russia doesn't have they can't waste as much as we do. They went to the very, very, you know, they hit rock bottom, as the expression goes, but they really did with Afghanistan and then Yeltsin with the first Chechen war. I mean, that is about as rock bottom as a former superpower could get, where they were just being laughed at. The Chechens were water skiing all over, you know, Russia, wherever they wanted to, taking entire towns hostage, winning over, you know, reporters, It was amazing. So yeah, and you know too from having lived in Russia. I mean, they are obsessed with America. They're obsessed positively and negatively. So they don't. I don't think they look at it like we can stick around and figure out how to resolve this later. I think they have much more of a sense of finite resources and finite than we do.
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah. And this was always a very limited intervention. Actually a remarkably effective one. 40 planes, say $1 billion, probably a lot less. That's very little to invest in a war. And the losses, one plane, one pilot, maybe a few extra casualties. Basically, they got away without any losses at all. It really was very carefully done. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's true. They've had some utter debacles. And it's not like they're building on a history of great success. But this was rather well done.
Yeah. And I think they also have a longer-term view of things that I would imagine one of the reasons we don't pull out, besides local crazy politics, is also that we have a sense that something has there's a problem, and you really can't leave until it's solved. And yes. I think most of the rest of the world understands that nothing is ever really solved. That you can, that it's going to unravel again at some point down the line, and so you have to take a bit more of a flexible, fluid view of things.
Absolutely, right? Trying to fix a country is like trying to fix a family.
Yeah.
By definition, a family can't be fixed. That's what they're about. And yeah, they were more realistic about that. But I think it also helped that they had only one client and no encumbering alliances, except maybe with Turkey, and they're not that tight with Turkey. But the U.S. has this alliance with Saudi Arabia, this alliance with Israel. Both those countries are insanely focused on destroying Hezbollah and any other Iranian ally in the Levant.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that we were backing everybody who was against them without realizing that it was an incredible mix-up of people who hated each other as well as, if not more than, they hated the Alawites. The Russians had one client. They wanted to help that client. They went in and said, okay, look, what's a defensible set of borders for you? You need Aleppo back. Okay, we'll bomb to help you get Aleppo. You need that coastal strip. You need this side of the hills, basically. Okay. No, let the Sunni have Idlib and the area around Idlib. It's too heavily Sunni for you to take. And if you look now, there's basically a coastal strip that's back in the hands of the the Syrian Arab Army and its allies. But there's a big hole in that around the city of Idlib, which is a strongly Sunni city and a strongly Sunni population around it. But instead of taking it, they're now fomenting dissent against Jabhat al-Nusra, the hardcore al-Qaeda affiliate. So there are many ways of messing with that enclave. You don't have to go in and take it.
Right. That's where they were burning down the al-Nusra headquarters.
Yeah.
And then next to them, you have the Syrian Kurds, who have announced that they want to create a sort of something like a confederation or a statelet on the northern border.
Yeah,
what do you think about that?
What is it Washington supposedly said? Somebody asked him, "What government have you given them?" And he said, "A republic, if they can keep it." And you know, yeah, it'd be nice to have Rojava if they can keep it. I'm frankly in favor of the YPGJ, the Kurdish Syrian militia. I mean, they've done a heroic job against Islamic State, which has been drawing dumbass jihadis from all over the world, as well as a strong core of Iraqi Sunni. And they are totally unlike any other fighting force in the area. They're non-sectarian. And they're not ethnically biased, as far as I can tell, either, despite continual attempts to portray them as being such. They give women equal roles in combat and command. They try not to genuflect any particular god. They're not saints, but they're light years better than anybody else in the region. So it would be nice if they could have Rojava, which is what they call the northern Syrian region that they've claimed and they want to make into an independent federation. I don't know if they can keep it. The Turkish army could roll over them, no question about that. Turkish army is very big, very powerful, and not overburdened with scruples. They could just roll through these lightly armed Kurds. And the only advantage the Kurds have, really, is because they're not super warriors. Their advantage is the U.S. Air Force, and there is no way on earth that the U.S. Air Force would bomb Turkish troops ever. In fact, if it comes down to it and Erdogan follows through with his it's her or me speech, which he made a while ago about the Kurds, there's no doubt what the U.S. would choose. It would choose Turkey. The U.S. has nuclear weapons in Turkish bases. They're not going to give that up.
And Erdogan seems to have formed a sort of an alliance with the Saudis as well, right? So
They're tight. Yeah, he's tight with a lot of Sunni Arab groups and countries, and sees himself as their natural leader. And some scary things have been happening in Turkey too. Like there was a big bombing in Ankara last week, which, by the way, I didn't know that Angora, you know, like the wool, come, that's what they call Ankara.
Oh, okay.
That wool is from those highland inner Anatolia sheep that had to go through the hard winters and grew some nice wool, I guess. But anyway, so somebody set off a suicide bomb in the center of Ankara, killed 37 people, wounded over 100. Suicide bombs have not traditionally been a Kurdish technique. The most famous one was Anna Merkan, who blew herself up at an Islamic State bastion just outside Kobani when the city was about to fall. But there have been a few Kurdish suicide bombers. And it looks like this was done by some Kurdish group. Now, the question is, what group? The big Kurdish group in Turkey is the PKK. That's a Kurdish militia. Mainly they fight in the east and southeast as guerrillas or sometimes as conventional fighters. They don't tend to do this kind of suicide attack, at least not in their own name. So a group has claimed that attack in Ankara. And the group calls itself TAK, the Freedom Falcons of Kurdistan, I think. And so the question is, who the hell are they? And, you know, in any guerrilla war, the first question is it a real group or is it a false flag attack? I don't mean false flag by the Turkish military. That's a little too conspiratorial. If they were going to do this, they'd probably stage a false flag attack in Istanbul, which is full of, you know, degenerates as they see it anyway. Right. They wouldn't hit their city, Ankara. The question is it the PKK using a false flag? You get this a lot, you know, where, especially with a movement like the PKK, which is struggling for legitimacy and doesn't want to do something that's going to look really bad in the Western press. The IRA was famous for doing, you know, well, there's a lot of argument about this, like how independent was the INLA? How independent were all these people? I mean, did they exist or were they for doing things that the IRA didn't want to claim? So there's a possibility this TAK is just a fake name for the PKK that it uses when it doesn't want to claim something that it still wants to do. But there's also the possibility, and this happens frequently too, that the TAK, as some people argue, used to be part of the PKK. There are communiques from the TAK saying, we are sick of, quote, the humanist policy, end quote, of the PKK. That is, this Öcalan thing is making them soppy and sentimental, and they're going soft. This happens all the time with guerrilla movements. I mean, there was a time when Hezbollah was nothing in the Shia communities of southern Lebanon. It was all Amal. And then Amal got soft and corrupt and got too interested in money, and Hezbollah took over. There's always room for a more radical group. And the Kurds are being hammered in southeast Turkey right now. They're being hit with artillery, with airstrikes, and the Turkish government has managed to keep most reporters out of cities like Cizre, so they can do what they want. God knows how many people are dying there. When that happens, people get mad.
Right.
People want to strike back. And some Kurds want vengeance. That's the TAK's slogan. If it really does exist, they want revenge. The PKK, like a lot of groups that are, you know, as I said, trying to be legitimate, they reject the idea of revenge. But a lot of people want revenge, not just fighters, but, you know, parents who've lost children, sisters who've lost brothers, they all want revenge.
And we've seen some of the photos and video of what the Turkish security forces have done in the Kurdish regions, right? Dragging corpses through the streets behind armored personnel carriers and... I mean, that stuff is...
Yeah, that was so common that I actually talked to a Turk in New Zealand who said he grew up watching that all the time. yeah, it was a common way of reminding people who was in charge. So yeah, unfortunately, the problem with doing revenge attacks when you're a guerrilla group is you don't control the media. The state controls the media. Mm-hmm. So everybody has seen a million images of those attacks in Ankara with blood in the streets, people being carried, covered with blood. And it is a horrible sight. The thing is, you don't see the horrible sights that are happening in the small towns of the southeast.
Yeah. So, but the Turkish security forces are saying is that the person responsible for the suicide bombing, she's a young woman, 24-year-old student from Kars province in eastern Turkey. Her name is Seher Kagladimir. I don't know. And they say that she was trained. She joined the PKK in 2013, received training from the YPG in Syria, you know, which may or may not be true. But the Turkish government wants to pin all of this on both the PKK and YPG, which is, you know, they want to fight.
Well, you know, if she did have that history, doesn't in itself prove that she's still PKK or YPG. What usually happens with this is someone says, your movement is a bunch of wimps. We're sick of not striking back. Going to start our own movements right back. So that the Turks may be telling the absolute truth, or they may be making an inference that's not really warranted.
And meanwhile, this happens at the same time that Erdogan has been really barreling headlong into a pretty close to something like a fascist, you know, regime. I mean, it is.
It's pretty shocking.
He's going much further than Putin, I think. When you watch this, it's pretty nuts.
Yeah, well, I don't think Putin has quite the ethnic problem Turkey has, and that's in two different ways. First of all, there's a big Kurdish and Alevi, two minorities in eastern Turkey, that the Erdogan faction isn't sure of. The other thing is Turkey, as I've said before, is a really fascinating study in how what used to be a very multi-ethnic state took Woodrow Wilson's lessons from Versailles and said, okay, if a nation is a bunch of people from the same ethnic group, then you've destroyed the Ottoman Empire. So we're not the Ottoman Empire. We are then Turkey. And then that means that everybody in Turkey is a Turk. Mm-hmm. And there was no regime that I know of in the world that took ethnic standardization to the same degree that Kemalist Turkey did. I mean, they made a lot of compromises to do that. They said, okay, we'll get rid of this religious stuff. They became massively secular. They became very Wilsonian in a lot of ways. You know, mm-hmm. like we are an ethnic nation. But that meant that there could not be any Kurds there. There could not even be any Alevi. There could not be any Anatolian Greeks. The Greeks were killed or kicked out. The Kurds were declared to be mountain Turks. So you had to either assimilate or die. And so there's no room for accommodation in a state like that. I mean, in the beginning, Erdogan seemed to be trying it, like saying, okay, you can have TV channels that broadcast in the Kurdish language, which had been forbidden. You used to get beaten for speaking Kurdish.
Right.
He allowed Kurdish to exist as an accepted language. But then he decided to play games in Syria, and the whole thing got way out of control. And he's decided that the independence of the Syrian Kurds is the most terrifying thing that could happen to Turkey, because you've got independent Kurds in Iraq. He's friends with them at the moment, but they're also giving refuge to PKK people on the Iraq-Turkish border. And then you've got this big Kurdish enclave in Syria that is now declaring its quasi-independence. And they're on two sides of Turkish Kurdistan. And it's not hard to figure out that soon the people inside Turkish Kurdistan are going to want those rights too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I wonder what he was thinking when he decided to get involved in Syria and the regime change there. I mean, it was a big gamble, a big political pivot for Turkey and for him. And I mean, everything has just taken on a crazy logic of its own ever since then.
I'll tell you an interesting story that I heard from somebody about this. I have no idea whether this is true. It seems like it's way too good to be true. But it's the kind of urban legend people tell to explain great cataclysms. Supposedly, or perhaps once upon a time, the Erdogans and the Assads used to vacation together. Have you heard this one?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Erdogan and Bashar al-Assad got along well enough, although, you know, Assad, who's typical, you know, coastal Levantine, he's very cultured, he speaks languages, he knows all that stuff, found Erdogan, who's an ex-jock, and, you know, he found him a little dumb. But it was Assad's wife, Asma, who could not stand Mrs. Erdogan. Because she said, the woman is a bumpkin. She speaks no languages. She's not interested in anything except shopping, which I find vulgar. Mm. And the MIT is a really good intelligence service, the Turkish intelligence. And they supposedly, no idea if this is true, but they supposedly reported all this back to Erdogan and Mrs. Erdogan. Now, Mrs. Erdogan, just to give you an idea, her state of mind, is famous for saying a couple of weeks ago that actually the Sultan's harem was a wonderful place, a place where women were educated for life. And that's true if you mean educated for another zombie-like decade or two of existence in a world where there's only one man allowed to have testicles. Yeah. I mean,
so she's basically like the Phyllis Schlafly of Turkey, or, you know, the Midge Dector. Yeah. Wow, okay.
Yeah, so you can see why she wouldn't really get along with the Assads, because the Alawites, you know, it's not so much that they're a different religion as that they aren't as religious as the inland Sunni are, which is very religious indeed. So that's the explanation I've heard of what went wrong. There are a lot of more sane explanations, like, you know, when this all started, Assad's people looked like falling easily. And if that had happened, it made sense to think that Turkey could have grabbed a lot of influence there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, both things may have happened, but I would give more credence to the second one, because it seemed to be that in those Arab Spring revolts that the weaker Arab regimes would fall unless the Saudis and propped them up with sort of U.S. backing, right? And obviously, no, they weren't going to back up Assad. So, yeah, he was going to get there.
In fact, I remember I was in Najran when this started. And one of the teachers there was a Syrian Kurd. And I've mentioned before, I once heard him in an argument screaming, I would rather have Shaitan, Satan, running my country than Assad. Because he was more Sunni than Kurd. And he hated Assad. So I asked him while this was starting, like, why is Assad still holding up? Why hasn't he fallen? Mm. And I'm sure he knew, but he didn't want to answer me. And the answer is Gaddafi and people like that, they didn't have any particular ethnic group backing them. Assad was, like it or not, the head of the Alawite sect. And the Alawites are a coextensive religion and ethnic group, like Jews were meant to be, like many religions are. And unlike Gaddafi, he had a whole group that knew they were likely to be killed or driven out if he fell. Mm-hmm. And that's why he survived.
Right.
But that wasn't clear at the time, not at all.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I want to just read you an article real quickly. This was in, I think it was Deutsche Welle is where I got it from. The headline is, Erdogan claims fighting terrorism outweighs democracy in Turkey. And here's where it starts. Combating terrorism is Turkey's highest priority, even higher than the rule of law, Turkish President Erdogan has said. Following a recent bomb attack in Ankara, he has pledged to crack down on Kurdish dissidents. Quote, democracy, freedom, and the rule of law have absolutely no value any longer, President Recep, blah, 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 Erdogan told, those who stand on our side in the fight against terrorism are our friend. Those on the opposite side are our enemy. And this is, he said this on television, Turkey will, quote, employ an iron fist against terrorism and fight the PKK militants. And so, yeah, so he's been going after academics, closing down the press.
Yeah, the traditional enemies of authoritarian people, the academics, the journalists. He closed down Zaman, the big opposition newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of backing for this. Mm-hmm. Turkey is one of those states that in weird ways is somewhat like the U.S. I mean, there's a real blue-red state divide in Turkey that makes ours look sort of tame. And I've seen a set of interviews from somebody on the street in Turkey just asking people what they think of atheists, and they all say, and because the PKK are seen as atheists.
Mm-hmm.
They are atheists,
they are,
basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're animals. They should be killed. Mm-hmm. And there's an ethnic dimension of that too. They're also Kurds, but as American voters would have said, law and order, when in a way they were talking about African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Atheists is a way of talking about Kurds as well.
Right.
So he can say this, and I think it's gonna work. I mean, someone described Erdogan's rule not as democracy but majoritarianism.
Right.
And in places like, say, Rwanda, where there are two ethnic groups who hate each other, and democracy can just mean we have more votes than you, and we vote to kill you all.
Mm-hmm. So what's going to happen there, do you think? I mean, I know that we try to shy away from predicting, but in that whole mess there,
I have trouble seeing the Kurdish areas of Kurdistan of Turkey getting any kind of autonomy while Erdogan's in power. And this sort of trouble actually helps rulers like him. People unite behind their ethnic group's representative. And unfortunately, that's how most Turks see Erdogan right now.
Mm-hmm.
He's their guy against the Kurds and the atheists and Iranians and the Russians and everybody else who menaces them. It's a country born out of a pretty nasty series of wars.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit on the paranoid side. So I don't think anything good is going to happen to southeastern Turkey, where the Kurds live, for a long time. I mean, if people want to read about this area, there's a great book called Rebel Land by Christopher de Bellaigue, and it's a good description of one small town which used to be surrounded by Armenian villages. They're all gone now, and it was the Kurds who did a lot of the killing when the Armenians were wiped out, but they did it at the behest of the Ottoman and post-Ottoman authorities. And now somebody else will be brought in, if need be, to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a nasty time.
Yeah, and it's worked for Erdogan. I mean, as he has heated up the ethnic tension and wars and so on and violence, I mean, it's worked for him. And he's trying to change the constitution now. I mean, as the violence heated up, he wound up gaining back enough seats in the parliament, right, so that he
Absolutely.
Can now change the constitution and...
That was his plan. There's a Kurdish party for the first time that's competing effectively in Turkish elections, the HDP. It got almost 14% of the vote. That was enough to cause Erdogan's party, the AKP, to lose its majority for the first time. So what Erdogan did, and this is classic, you might say, dirty democracy technique, he heated up the war in the southeast.
Mm-hmm.
And provoked Kurdish counterattacks, and then blasted them all over the Turkish media. And the average, Archie Bunker voter sees something like that and says, "Ah, oh, those goddamn Kurds, give them an inch." So the second election held within a couple of months, and boom, his party was back in power.
Yep, and it wound up aligning the urban, as you've talked about, sort of the blue state, Istanbul, the people who've been protesting as Erdogan, it aligned them with suddenly terrorists again. It's the
country
and the enemy of the Turkish people.
Yeah.
So yeah, it works. So we're now, we're an hour and 20 minutes in the show, and we've been trying to keep a bit of a lid on this. So I'm not sure what we should do. I mean, did we want to talk about radicalization after what just happened in Belgium? And then we also wanted to talk about Taliban shuffle. So do we want to talk about I'll give you the warner, one or the other. You choose, gun to your head.
Let's talk about the Taliban shuffle, because people have said they want more literary stuff. And this is a book that we both liked and one that's been somewhat controversial.
Okay, good. Yeah, a quick little intro to it. So it's now a movie with Tina Fey. And it's funny, I saw David Filipov. I don't know if you remember him. So he was a Boston Globe correspondent in Russia. And he just did a review of it. And he said, I really wanted to hate this movie because he also he was in Afghanistan, I think, 2001, too, and then maybe another time. He said, I wanted to hate it, but it turned out to be really good. And I wrote to him briefly and I said, yeah, I wanted to hate the book, but it turned out to be really, really good. So why don't you talk about it?
Okay, this is a memoir of war journalism by a woman named Kim Barker, who was in Afghanistan and then in Pakistan in the very beginning of the century. So she saw the war in Afghanistan get sidetracked by the disastrous adventure in Iraq. And she described that very effectively. But what she describes best of all is some of the nasty side of being in a place like Afghanistan. And this got her in trouble, with an area specialist named Christine Fair, who wrote a very sniffy, sanctimonious article in the Huffington Post called Baffled by the Taliban Shuffle, where she basically morally objects to the book because she said, and she uses the word micturating, just like Lebowski himself.
Yes.
She says that by talking about all the dirty aspects of being an American expat in a war zone, Kim Barker has micturated upon her, that is Christine Fair's, turf.
Turf, it's a carpet, kind of.
Yeah, that's right. Let me understand this, sir.
Everyone who is miturated upon my turf, I have to bear.
Yeah, that's pretty much what she says. And so Fair's conclusion.
I think she went to the Michael Weiss School of Thesaurus writing there.
Miturated. I know. These guys have got to calm down with the vocabulary here.
They're
okay?
Yeah.
We all studied for the SAT, but some of us got over that, okay? Micturation is to, what's that smell as, anyway, okay. All right, so here's how Fair concludes her very annoyed review. While the author admits her flaws in varying measure, at some point her self-deprecating account of the romps, there's a lot of fist shaking in that romps, seem more like gimmicky braggadocio rather than self-reflective criticism, much less exculpation for region-wide offenses. This is unfortunate. The author has an innately appealing voice and a good eye for human comedy. Nonetheless, while the volume is nominally set to the tune of the Taliban, in fact, it's set to the tune of the author's own narcissism. Okay.
Tisk, tisk, tisk.
Yeah.
Tisk, it's actually infuriating. It's much worse than tisk, tisk, tisk. Isn't
yeah.
It? It's basically saying good comic writing and a good comic eye is has no value.
No value
makes
at all.
You a bad person.
Yeah, I mean, it reminded me of Moscow in a way, like Barker writes about being bitterly alienated in Afghanistan, being horrified by a lot of things she says, getting people in trouble because she's stupid. I mean, she writes about a squad of American soldiers, and she describes how bored they are and nothing's happening. And the next thing she knows after her story comes out, they've been sent to a combat zone. She confesses that, and then she's vilified for confessing that. And one thing I know from the years I spent in Moscow is the people who write about sinning in places like that, it's not a complete over Venn diagram overlap with those who sinned in that place.
Mm-hmm.
There's a massive sort of dark matter of those who sinned, often very spectacularly, and never said a goddamn word about it. And the trouble with critiques like Fair's is that that's perfectly okay with her. What's not okay with her is sinning and saying you sinned, getting something wrong and saying you got it wrong.
I think that's what everybody hates about the exile still. I mean, we took our sins and exaggerated, you know, basically made that the front and center, exaggerated them so that they can, you know, so that they were front and center to the story. And you know, especially at a time when we saw what was going on, where people were being horrible everywhere, absolutely horrible and deadly, you know, to Russia. And then turning around and smiling and talking about how, you know, poor Russians, they just don't get it.
And I know, you know, people from Moscow who very cleverly managed not to blot the old copybook while doing some serious stuff. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so Barker actually does a better job of describing that aspect of grim, desperate expat hedonism than anyone else I've read. I mean, she actually says that she felt like she was back in high school, and she describes it as Kabul High.
Right.
She describes a lot of generally unhappy sexual escapades, generally unhappy drunkenness, and constant misunderstanding and rage at the misunderstanding. I mean, one of the things that makes Christine Fair so angry is that at one point Barker says, they spoiled my expensive shirt and I yelled at them. Mm-hmm. And then my fixer told me, you don't do that in Afghanistan, you have to be softer. And she adds something like, I was surprised because that would have worked in Pakistan, where she started out. And that's the kind of thing you really get after you've been in a place like that. There are places where you yell, there are places where you don't yell.
Yeah, and the reviewer, this Georgetown professor, Christine Fair, wanted actually to make her just look like an ugly American. And that was what I expected when I read it, and that she was just an arrogant, ugly American who, you know, yells at people. But having lived in Russia and stuff, I know that there are times when you are supposed to do it that way, and you're an idiot if you don't. And there are other times where it's way out of place, or in other cultures and stuff, it's not easy to get. So, and there are just some great moments in her book as well. I mean...
Yeah, she writes well.
Yes.
I guess I haven't mentioned that clearly enough. She's good.
She is. She's brave. I think the bravery maybe is what bothered this reviewer. Because not a lot of American writers, certainly people talking about foreign policy, have that bravery.
Fair tisks at her for getting annoyed. If Fair actually spent decades in Central Asia and didn't get annoyed, she's a lunatic.
So I want to read a little passage here. So this is when it's early on in the book. It's when she's about to go to a wedding. It's her fixer's wedding in Kabul. And so Barker writes, so she came out for it from India. She didn't really have much to wear. She writes here, I looked in the mirror and performed a harsh... Oh, one second, let me switch the page here in the stupid thing. Jesus Christ. Hold on here. A harsh self-assessment. I would never be described as a beautiful woman, but I could usually pass for cute and occasionally, when viewed in a certain light, even sexy. But I had not really taken care of myself since coming overseas. I hadn't had a haircut in 5 months, and my split ends and slight curl gave me a frizzy aura. In my chronic hair wars, my gray roots were overtaking my brown ends. I had nothing to cover my under-eye circles, and I definitely gained weight and acquired a bad complexion due to a diet of kebabs, rice, bread, and oil. On this night, I could perform little magic. You don't get a lot of that.
It's very painful, a lot of the stuff she writes about. She writes about a boyfriend who's, he seems like kind of a loser, and he just kind of goes crazy in Delhi, where her base is for a while. He starts getting paranoid and he can't handle it. And meanwhile, she's just looking for a way to get rid of him anyway. And that frequently happens when you end up in a weird place or a war zone.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen this again and again, and somebody brings a spouse over or something. It's not really going to work, because either you get attracted to that kind of tension, or you hate it like you wouldn't believe. Mm-hmm. And often it's one who's attracted to it and the other hates it. And yeah. you know they're not going to stick together.
Yeah. Yeah. And then she, and then her stories, I mean, she doesn't boast. That's the other thing about Fair's review. It makes it seem like Barker's boasting. Yeah, braggadocio, of course. And she's not. This is not bragging when she talks about her gray roots coming out and her... It is sad, it is painful, and it's funny because it's honest. So I want to read another little passage here where she I guess, has a one-nighter. So she with this guy, Jeremy, we saw each other a week later as he passed through Kabul on his way out of the country for vacation for lunch. We held hands beneath the table, kissed goodbye quickly in the path. Neither one of us necessarily wanted anyone else to know that we were attempting to date, kind of. We spoke in staccato sentences with abrupt punctuation, not wanting to reveal too much or ask for too much. Quote, "It's been really nice getting to know you," I said. Quote, "Well, you know, I don't want anything serious. I mean, I'm not, you don't think." "Of course," I interrupted. "You know, I don't want anything serious, obviously, but it's nice, you know." "Well, yeah, I like hanging out. We'll see what happens." "Totally. Have a great vacation." And then she writes later, looking back, seventh grade. Kabul was a fishbowl and not conducive to actual dating, even though the foreign women were vastly outnumbered by the foreign men. Our attractiveness rate skyrocketed accordingly. A 10 in Kabul became a 5 as soon as she walked off the plane in Dubai. We were Kabul cute, we were mission pretty. But still, the men here rarely ask the woman out on actual dates. In that, Jeremy was an anomaly. So yeah, it's not sexy. It's not.
No, it's the opposite. It's painful. Bragging, yeah. It's quite painful. And that all rings true. I mean, if you've been in rough places, all this is perfectly true. And it's just weird that it's a sin to talk this way when it's an experience that anybody who's been there and is being honest with themselves will appreciate. Because for one thing, she writes some great dialogue. That's mm-hmm. worthy of a Big Lebowski scene mm-hmm. there.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say if there's one sin, it's that she's very talented and that she made money off it. From my point of view, that's a sin. But, you know, you have to give due. You have to give talent due. And she's a good writer. So I would definitely recommend anybody to buy this book. It's a really good read. It's very smart. It does actually have very good, intelligent insights into the clusterfuck.
For one thing, I've never seen a better demonstration of what happened when they shifted the resources from Afghanistan to Iraq. I mean, the Afghans tell her, they tell her over and over, you're going to regret this. This is going to hurt.
Yeah.
I think it's a very good book. I have nothing to say about the movie. I ain't seen it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. The book is good.
Get the book. Yes. Okay. And I think on that note, we've hit we've gone past the 90-minute mark, but we haven't hit the 2-hour mark, so we're kind of still in there in that zone. So let's finish up, and until next week, I guess that's it for the show. Thanks everyone for joining us.
Yeah, thanks very much.
All right, bye, John.
Okay, bye, bye.